You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Fundamentals of Securities Law, Part 1. I am pleased to hand the program over to Nathaniel Trelease of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, who will moderate today's program. Mr. Trelease?
Thank you, Nicole. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker today, Eric Smith. Eric joins us today from his offices in Baltimore, Maryland, where he is a partner with Venable LLP. Eric represents closely held and publicly traded companies in capital raising transactions, mergers and acquisitions, and in joint ventures. He has extensive experience advising companies on security compliance issues in capital raising, periodic reporting, the fiduciary duties of directors, and communications with stockholders. Eric is a member of the ABA Committee on Federal Regulation of Securities and also a member of the Committee on Corporate Governance. Today's program is the first of two parts in which Eric is discussing the fundamentals of securities law. In today's program, he will provide us with a broad framework for understanding the overarching requirements of securities law, focusing initially on what is encompassed within the term securities, which generally includes more than merely corporate stock. Today, he will also discuss disclosure requirements in capital raising, anti-fraud provisions of law, and also specific security issues in M&A. Tomorrow, however, we will drill down into specific issues in private placements, whether you're raising equity or in other transactions trying to raise credit or issuing bonds. He will, in that connection, discuss restrictions on private placements, exemption planning, including reliance on Regulation D, understanding the differences between exempt securities on the one hand and exempt offerings on the other, including related issues of who is an accredited investor, together with many other requirements. Eric, this is a large and complicated field, but one that's very important that touches operations and clearly capital raising of a lot of closely held companies. Can't think of anybody better to have on this topic than you. Thank you for joining us. I invite you to begin.
Nate, thanks very much for the introduction and for having me today. I guess I will jump right into my presentation, moving to slide 2, which I just want to go the very basic background of kind of pointing out the securities laws and the fact that they are, you know, very much a outgrowth of the Great Depression and the need for full and fair disclosure that presumably did not exist prior to those rules, or at least a lot of issues arose relating to the lack of information that was out there. And it's worth kind of remembering that that's the, in all the different transactions, that's kind of the fundamental goal, is getting the full and fair disclosure out to the people that are making their investment decisions, whether that means buying and selling a security or voting on a corporate transaction that will impact how their security is held. One piece that you know should never be overlooked and is very basic that Nate referenced is first checking whether or not the problem you're dealing with involves a security. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later. But frequently you'll get in other investment activity where people start to worry about whether or not someone is a broker-dealer or an investment advisor or some other action, and they've kind of jumped over the question of whether or not the investment that's involved is a security, which a lot of times, or in some instances, I guess I should say, can kind of put the issue to bed right away if it's not a security. On the other hand, there's a lot of things that people think of that are indeed securities that may not, on their face, you know, jump out in that way, in the same way that a share of stock would. On to the third slide. Wanted to talk about the basic framework and what the SEC's five main responsibilities are. The first is to enforce disclosure requirements, whether that means causing people and companies to make proper disclosure in accordance with their requirements, or to enforce them through through enforcement actions. The next is regulation of the securities markets, which includes regulating the exchanges, regulating the broker-dealers, and the periodic reporting requirements of public companies. There's the regulation of mutual funds and other investment companies, including private equity funds and hedge funds. The next is the regulation of investment advisors, so those that provide advice to anyone that's investing in securities. And then finally, one of the main responsibilities of the SEC is to oversee the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which, working together with FASB, sets the accounting rules and helps to enforce them and make sure that the information that's disseminated and filed with the SEC is in compliance with those rules. I won't talk a whole lot more about that because that is more of an accounting function from a technical perspective. To slide four, I wanted to point out kind of the key statutes so we can get the overview. The first one is the Securities Act of 1933, which largely deals with the disclosure around purchasing and selling securities. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which deals with the regulation of the securities markets, as I mentioned, the Exchange Act, the securities exchanges, NASDAQ, NYSE, the broker-dealers, and then the periodic disclosure requirements of the of public companies. The Investment Company Act, which deals with deals with mutual funds as an investment company, and then other requirements on other investment companies such as private equity funds and hedge funds, although many of those are exempt under that act, but that's the act that regulates those investment companies. The Investment Advisors Act of 1940, which, as evidenced by its name, regulates investment advisors. One item that people frequently kind of get to without, they focus on the federal securities laws, and especially in the private company context, it's important, and it's important in all instances, but it is less frequently preempted as the state securities laws in the private company context. So frequently people will talk about the requirements of the federal securities laws thinking that it's been preempted by the National Securities Markets Improvement Act of 1996, but there's many instances where it is not. So checking both the federal securities laws and the state securities laws is certainly necessary and important. And then it's worth also reminding, because where many of the practical responses or answers to questions about regulations and the statutes come in, and the implementation of the statutes is in all the different regulations that are either adopted by the SEC or by the state securities commissioners, are just the various regulations. Also want to talk about, because when you're reviewing securities laws issues, there's a number of interpretive guidance, which is of course very helpful when you're trying to answer a specific question. For someone who doesn't spend a lot of time working with the securities laws, it can be a little bit overwhelming, or can raise the question of, oh, have I checked all of the different places where there might be guidance available? And some of the key items where there is helpful guidance from the SEC or at the state level. The SEC, when it adopts rules, has rule releases that discusses those rules and the various comments and the various thinking about the adoption of those rules, and that can be very helpful to understand some areas that may be gray when you read just the letter of the regulations. There is also compliance and disclosure interpretations, which, you know, were previously referred to as telephone interpretations, and they are questions and answers published by the SEC that are usually in a fairly short, in a relatively short framework, and they're questions that come up somewhat regularly but are not specifically addressed in the regs or the statute, but can be very helpful in terms of getting a specific answer to a fact scenario that because a lot of times people will be looking at something and say, well, people must have addressed this question a million different times, even though it may not be clear in the reg or the statute, and frequently there'll be answers to those questions in the CD&Is. Another place to find guidance is in no action letters from the SEC when people submit their specific questions and ask that the SEC provide indication that they won't take any action if a company follows through on what is described in the letter, or the SEC may respond and say they can't provide that comfort that they won't take no action. Additional guidance can come in the way of comment letters to registrants when people are trying to determine what may or may not be material, whether or not the SEC is addressed in the industry and had similar discussions back and forth with specific companies. You can review the comment letters that go back and forth between the SEC and the companies, the registrants. There's also, for more detailed items, there are staff accounting bulletins and staff legal bulletins that the SEC staff puts out. You know, an example of that one would be if you were doing a tender offer, there's a lot of guidance in staff legal bulletins related to that. There's also a lot of guidance in shareholder proposals. And then the other item that is helpful as guidance if you're looking at it as a private company or is, you know, in a requirement if you're a public company, is all the different forms and reports. The 10-Ks, 10-Qs, the proxy statements, which I referred to here as the definitive 14A, the 8-Ks and the S-1s, these are all items that can provide you a guidance as to what may be needed when making disclosures on various topics, whether it's in some type of annual report or an offering document or seeking stockholder votes on a topic. Up to slide 6 now. I wanted to quickly mention the three relatively recent acts, which is the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, Dodd-Frank in 2010, and the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act in 2012, which have a lot of issues and come up with a lot of reference, with a lot of frequent reference when people are asking questions about whether or not the securities laws apply, how they apply. Sarbanes-Oxley particularly comes up when people are talking about internal controls and whether or not certain activity is prohibited in connection with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is frequently a shorthand for saying that a company doesn't permit something to happen because it's not in compliance with its internal controls. There is not necessarily a specific provision in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that lays out how those internal controls are laid out, but it does require that the company set those up. And as a result, frequently people just refer to it as a Sarbanes-Oxley requirement, when indeed it's a method of complying with Sarbanes-Oxley by setting up internal controls. And then there's a number of items that came in under the Dodd-Frank Act. I don't think it's worth going into too much detail on that. The Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, the Jobs Act, which provided a lot of different items, some of which I'll talk about in more detail in the second part of the presentation, relating to crowdfunding, public solicitations, and private offerings. There's also provides for reduced disclosure for emerging growth companies when they go public, and those are smaller companies as they go public, and providing some relief to them. And there's a number of other items that are intended to assist smaller companies with raising capital. And there are still a number of items under both Dodd-Frank and the Jobs Act that are still still to be implemented that were called for by that act. One of the larger ones is the one that gets more a lot of attention is the crowdfunding, and then also Regulation A plus, both of which I'll talk about later, but neither of which have yet been adopted and can be used at this point, although there's certainly discussions about that happening shortly, but no specific guidance from the SEC at this point. On to slide 7, wanted to talk a little bit about liability under the securities laws. And there is generally both criminal, SEC, and private actions. They're all potential places for liability. And, you know, it depends on the statute in whether or not any or all of these, certainly some of them, will apply for a violation. And the penalties are usually related to the injury that happens to an investor as opposed to some type of set penalty that's penalty kind of schedule that would be laid out by the SEC. There is not, you know, by comparison, the kind of treble damages approach that the antitrust laws take. But there are various places, and including criminal actions, that can follow from violations of the securities laws. Some of the key statutes for dealing with liability, one is the anti-fraud statutes, which apply regardless of whether you're a public company or a private company. It's kind of it's the statement that always is made, which is, you know, even if you're exempt from, because you're not a public company, from registration or other items, you're going to be subject to any type of anti-fraud rules, which is really, I mean, there's a number of other pieces, but the key one that continues to come up, that regularly comes up in the offering or the stockholder voting context, is making any statements that are misleading or, and importantly, leaving out any statements that would cause the statements that were made to be misleading. So, you know, if you say something, it's got to be complete and accurate. Another statute for liability relates to insider trading, and that's, you know, buying and selling securities when without full disclosure, and that can happen in either public company or private company context, although it's certainly a lot more prevalent in terms of the enforcement actions in the public company context, and especially with regards to compliance with filing obligations. And then the next one that I reference is failure to make disclosure and filings and misstatements and public filings, and that relates back to the anti-fraud statutes, and then there's also some specific requirements in the public company context when you're doing an offering that provides for liabilities to the registrant, directors, officers, and the underwriters. On to slide 8, because I think it's a topic worth going through quickly, especially if we are dealing with people that are in that realm of frequently or expecting to be a private company, thinking about whether or not they want to be a public company and making sure that they are not inadvertently a public company when they think that they should be a private company. So I thought I would go through those issues. I'm up to slide 9 now. So it's section 12G of the 34 Act, which provides that if you have more than 500 shareholders of record that are not accredited, or up to 2,000 shareholders of record if less than 500 are non-accredited. You have more than $10 million in assets, and it's if the test is met at the end of a fiscal year, then you must register under the 34 Act. This has been expanded substantially as a result of the Jobs Act as well, which went from the 500 to the 2,000 number, which makes it a little bit less likely for people to kind of inadvertently fall in this. A lot of times where this topic has come up in the past is as companies have grown and they issue a lot of options or warrants or other things to employees, and their company grows and they all of a sudden find out that they have, you know, over 500, maybe it's a lot less likely that you're going to end up with over 2,000. But if you end up with over 500 that are not accredited, so they're not, you know, a net worth of over $1 million or have an income individually of 200 or more or 300 or more. I'll discuss the accredited investor definition a little bit more later, but that's kind of the place where you start to worry. When you start to have a big number of shareholders, you want to make sure that you haven't inadvertently caused yourself to have to register with the SEC. A little bit more detail on that. Securities held by persons who receive the securities under an employee compensation plan in a transaction exempt from registration are not considered to be held of record for purposes of the record holder calculation. And this is tended to give relief to the concern I was talking about before, which is when you end up with employees with options. There is also the crowdfunding calculation, which now provides that securities issued under the crowdfunding exemption of 4A6 of the Securities Act would be excluded from being counted as a record holder under 12G. And then there is a discussion of the beneficial ownership, and that rule, 12G51B3, requires that beneficial holders be counted as record holders if the issuer knows or has reason to know that the form of ownership of securities is being used to circumvent the record holder calculation. And that concept of if you can't do it directly, doing it indirectly is not really going to work. It's the kind of principles-based approach to the regulations, which you'll see in a number of places in the securities laws where the rules say you can't do indirectly, or you can't, if you're doing something to circumvent a rule, then you're not going to be permitted to do it. It's going to be deemed to be the same violation. The consequences of becoming a 34 Act, or there's a number of them, but it quickly kind of, you know, it changes the character of the company and the reporting requirements and the public nature of the company. Some specific requirements relate to periodic reporting, which is the annual report, the quarterly report, the interim reports on current events. There is all the proxy and tender offer rules. In terms of shareholder voting and shareholder repurchasing shareholder stock, there's Section 16, which is all the insider trading rules that apply to the directors and officers of a public company. So there's a substantial overlay if you were to become a 34 Act reporting company. Next, I want to talk about the application of the securities laws to closely held companies. As kind of an overview in the topics, the first is in raising capital. There is there's going to be application of the securities laws with regards to that's going to require disclosure and capital raising. There's also going to be issues relating to broker-dealer in the event that you're working with someone that's assisting in raising capital on how they're compensated. There's always a question of, you know, if you have a third party that's getting compensated for helping with the transaction, then the question of whether or not they're a licensed broker dealer, and if they're not, then that being someone that, you know, may be in violation of the securities laws and could result in penalties for the issuer as well. And then there is also, when you're raising capital, there are the filing requirements, both the federal and state level, if depending on what type of offering capital raising transaction you're engaging in. The next one is for repurchasing outstanding securities and whether or not there is whether or not that transaction is going to be a tender offer, and that redemption and it's going to be subject to the tender offer rules. I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later. The updating existing security holders, and in a private company context, there's not likely to be a lot of requirements there, but the the practical issue of whether or not you have a number of stockholders that maybe aren't informed, that always thinking about, okay, while things are happy, we want to make sure we keep them informed. If things aren't so happy, we also probably want to keep them informed, because one of the complaints that frequently happens in the private company context, that when a company is kind of going along and not providing information to its shareholders, is when something does go wrong, there's a lot of unhappiness about, why wasn't I told? Why didn't I know it was coming up? People then start looking for avenues of litigation. Just as in my experience, that can be reduced to some degree if there is a continuous conversation with the stockholders, whether it's a private company or a public company. On to slide 13, in the mergers and acquisition context, the securities laws generally kind of insert themselves with regard to any stock issuances, and this can be if there's a stock-for-stock transaction where someone is just exchanging stock in compliance with the rules there, because that's going to be an issuance by the company issuing the stock. The acquisition of stock, which is another place if a company is being bought in a stock deal, that can create questions around disclosure on the stock that's being purchased. It can also create questions relating to whether or not someone that helped put the deal together, whether or not they comply with the broker-dealer rules. And then finally, if there is a stockholder decision to be made by a group that isn't fully informed, whether or not there is a disclosure document that needs to go out to them to make sure that they have sufficient information at the time that they are making their investment decisions. Another item that is related to sometimes related to M&A transactions, but may is also just a continuing obligation, which relates to ownership in a public company, whether that's owned by an individual or a private company or a private investment fund or some other type of non-registered entity, but that it owns a substantial amount of securities, or someone involved becomes a director of a public company. And here, there are beneficial ownership reporting requirements, which are the Schedule 13D and 13G filing obligations, and that comes up if you are over 5%, if you own over 5% of a public company. And then frequently you'll have a situation where if someone owns a substantial amount of a public company, that person or a person associated with the company that owns it will appoint a director or otherwise have insider trading filing obligations, which if you're over 5%, you don't trigger those unless you are a director or officer. Once you go over 10% and you're a beneficial owner of over 10% of a public company, then you have the insider trading filing obligations under Section 16. And there is certainly a very vibrant plaintiff's bar that tracks the filing of those Section 16s and the Section 16 forms and the timeliness of those filings. So it's important to know that if you're going to be involved, even if you're not a public company, if you're going to be involved in owning securities of a public company, you're going to have filing obligations associated with that. Now I'm up to slide 14, which is where I start to go into this question of kind of what is a security, which, as I mentioned at the outset, it can be a very fundamental question that frequently is not quite as straightforward on initial blush most people expect it to be. There's different definitions of what a security is, but all of them, as a general matter, are pretty much identical, and they talk about a list of items that are securities, which includes a note, stock, treasury stock, securities, futures, bonds, debentures, indebtedness, certificates of interest, participations in profit sharing agreements, and investment contracts. And I'll come back to investment contracts because that's one that's fairly generic, but encompasses a lot of potential investment structures. And then it also goes with that the general language that says that is, in general, any interest or instrument commonly known as a security or any guarantee, warrant, or right to subscribe to or purchase any of those items. To slide 15, there is kind of the clear item that says, okay, clearly stock and other ownership in an operating company will be a security. So when you're buying stock on a stock exchange, clearly that's a security. Or if you are, you know, the stockholder, you know, you and three other people are the stockholder of a company, you own a security. The debt instruments can oftentimes be securities as well. Examples of that are things like asset-backed or mortgage-backed securities, mortgage interest, bonds, debentures, notes, other types of evidence of debt that are frequently securities. The other end of the spectrum, if the investment is just, you know, is real estate, is just dirt or buildings or other kind of hard assets, that's clearly not going to be a security. But the intersection of causing that interest in a hard asset to become a passive ownership interest is when it's likely to transform the character of that investment into being a security. So ownership of an LLC, corporation, partnership, joint venture, private fund, or other item like that, even if the underlying asset is still just dirt or buildings or hard assets, it's a passive ownership in that sense, it's likely to still be a security. Some unexpected securities, and this gives maybe some context to the examples of the types of items that might be securities, would be an interest in an orange grove has been determined to be a security because it was set up in a way where people we're investing in the orange grove. Someone else is managing the orange grove and selling the oranges and the oranges from the orange grove and then giving the investors the profits. So although it's an interest in an orange grove that is, you know, a contractual interest, that has been determined to be a security. Similarly, tax increment financing, real estate structure where there is interests in a pool of real estate with the intention of providing tax benefits, specifically people doing things like trying to get 1031 exchange tax benefits when they sell out as a security, then putting the money into some type of tax increment financing that's managed by a third party. Questions are raised there. Okay, if it's managed by a third party, it's an interest in real estate, that may be a security. Those are the kind of contracts that frequently get caught up in the definition of security that sometimes people don't expect. Slide 16, the way that those items that I was talking about get caught up in there in the definition of security is generally through the definition of an investment contract, which there has been a good deal of discussion in the common law. The SEC versus Howery case is the one that lays out how that analysis is done. So an investment contract is going to be an investment of money in a common enterprise with an expectation of profits from the efforts of others. And this definition is intended to look at the quote-unquote economic reality, and it's intended to be a flexible definition to meet the countless and variable schemes devised by those who would seek to use the money of others on the promise of profits. So as you can tell, it's intended to be flexible and broad in terms of anyone that is kind of taking the money of others for the promise of profits. On to slide 17, the talking specifically about a few other items. When you talk about LLC interests, there are some instances where an LLC interest may not be if it's a wholly owned subsidiary that owns a piece of real estate that is controlled by the entity or the person that owns it, then that, you know, be less likely to be a passive ownership interest that is relying on the efforts of others in some type of common enterprise. So there's, you know, a position to be taken there that may not be a security. On the other hand, if there's a passive interest in an LLC, then that almost certainly is. California has specifically said that it's presumed that an LLC interest is a security unless all the members are actively engaged in management, not merely have the rights to be engaged in management, but are actively engaged in management. So that's just an example of one state's approach that further highlights the way that a determination is made sometimes about what is and is not a security. A joint venture is likely a security for at least one of the partners, if not both, unless they are both managing, controlling. You could say that it needs to be 50-50, but there's a number of different ways that you can structure a joint venture to give rights that when the ownership interest may not be 50-50. So you have to look into the facts and the specifics of a joint venture to determine whether or not it's going to be a security for one or the other or both parties. Promissory notes are another item that frequently raise questions. If you have a single note that is secured by an asset, that it's probably not a security because there's no kind of common enterprise there. If you know, a bank loans money to a person to buy a house, that's unlikely to be a security. The other end of the spectrum is, you know, a series of promissory notes issued by a company, and that probably is a security. That's the common enterprise item, and there's also something that's referred to as the family resemblance test. If it resembles, you know, if it kind of has a family resemblance to a security. The next, I want to go on to the next slide, which is page 18, and talk about the disclosure requirements and transactions for closely held companies. I'll just read quickly through the anti-fraud, the Rule 10b-5 language that also appears in some other sections of the securities laws, but lays out what the disclosure requirements frequently are, whether it's a private company or a public company or some type of private equity fund that is issuing an interest. And that is that it's unlawful in connection with the purchase or sale of security. So that gets back to, okay, are we dealing with a security? But assuming that we are, it's unlawful to employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud, to make any untrue statement of a material fact or omit to state a material fact necessarily in order to make the statements made in light of the circumstances under which they were made not misleading, or to engage in any act which operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon any person. The private company context is, I'm on to slide 19 now, is a much less structured in terms of the requirements of what needs to be disclosed. In the public company context, there's all the forms and the schedules that lay out what needs to be disclosed, and some degree maybe lays out what is determined to be likely to be material to an investor. In the private context, it's going to be very fact specific in terms of what disclosure is necessary. There's not forms that lay out exactly what's needed, but it doesn't mean that the disclosure is not required. And some of the facts that need to be looked at is the number of parties involved, the prior existing disclosure that may have been provided, the investment decision to be made, whether or not the security holders are voting on a transaction, investing in a company or selling securities, and the sophistication level of the parties and the leverage of the parties available to them to protect themselves. And that all gets into when you're looking at who the investors or the stockholders, the people that are being asked to make a decision, are, whether or not they have been given material and received whatever material they've asked for, if they have access to that material, and making sure that, you know, if you have two owners of a business that know everything that's going on, you can get a lot more comfortable than if you have 100 stockholders that are being asked to vote on a transaction that don't have any idea where the company is going or what's happening, and you kind of raise the questions there of what is the whether or not misleading statements have been made and whether or not the full disclosure that's appropriate has been provided. I just note on slide 20 that given the structure of 10b-5 and the disclosure obligations, providing that any untrue statement of material fact or omitting to state a material fact necessary in order to make the statements made in light of the circumstances not misleading, that lays out the result, which is that once some disclosure has been made, you need to consider the need for additional statements to avoid misleading investors. So a lot of times people will be hesitant to want to provide information, but to have people react, they're going to demand that information. Once you give some of that information, you have to be clear that you're giving the full set of information so that what you've provided is not misleading. On to slide 21, talking about securities issued in a private merger and acquisition transaction. So it's the purchase or sale of securities as opposed to assets. If you're just buying and selling assets, then you're less likely to have these issues. The issuance of new securities as consideration in a transaction, so you have a partial or all stock consideration, and that will trigger those disclosure obligations when someone's deciding essentially whether or not to turn in their current securities for cash and securities of another company, which triggers all of the securities laws that apply, especially the 10b-5 and the related disclosure obligations. And then, as I mentioned previously, in M&A transactions, you have the question of whether or not someone that's involved is an M&A broker. As a note, there has been a no-action letter that has some specific requirements that has been published by the SEC in response to a request that provides some very helpful relief in the context of M&A brokers. It's worth going and taking a look at that. If you're working with an M&A broker or that is not a licensed broker-dealer, because they will sometimes be exempt depending on the facts of the M&A transaction, and provided that it is a complete sale of the company and there's not financing being provided by the M&A broker and some other specific items. On to number 22, which is related to what I was talking about in terms of private M&A transactions. If you're doing a transaction, whether it's a purchase and sale of a company or it's a tender offer for the securities, outstanding stock or other securities of an entity, then the Regulation 14E that regulates tender offers will apply. In the private company context, Regulation 14D is not going to apply, but 14E would apply, and that sometimes is surprising to private company owners and their advisors, that the tender offer rules do specifically lay out certain items that apply in if you're going to do a tender offer. And those rules include the broad anti-fraud rules, which are similar to the 10b-5 disclosure obligations. There is a provision that provides that an offer needs to stay open for 20 days and must be kept open for at least 10 days following a change in price or percentage sought. The tender only purchases, so you can't purchase any target securities other than pursuant to an offer during the tender offer period. And the commitment, this requires that the bidder intend to commence within a reasonable time and have a reasonable belief that it will have the means to purchase the security. That goes a little bit back to the anti-fraud. You can't go out and say you're going to do a tender offer and not do it. Once people kind of recognize that if they're doing a tender offer, there are these regulations, the next question frequently becomes, okay, so what is a tender offer? Which is not defined in the securities, in the statute to the regs. I laid out the eight factors that on slide 23. I laid out the eight factors that have been provided in the common law and is generally what's followed in terms of trying to make a determination of whether or not something is indeed a tender offer. And as I noted here at the top, that this is not that you have to satisfy each of these. This is a totality of the circumstances determination, and it is intended to say, okay, if something is a tender offer, if it is likely to be coercive and put pressure on a stockholder, because the rules are intended to reduce that pressure. So the eight factors include active and widespread solicitation as opposed to individually negotiated transactions at different prices, solicitation for a substantial percentage of outstanding shares. Again, that goes to the individual negotiation, although if you are to go out and make a general offer for 10%, presumably that may still be a tender offer if it fits within a number of the other elements referenced here. The offer is at a premium to the market price. The offer terms are fixed and not negotiable. The offer is contingent on tender of a fixed minimum number of shares. There's a limited period of time to decide. The offeree is subject to pressure to sell, and the existence of publicity to purchasers. And so you can see how that those items, while all of them may not exist, if some or a majority of them exist, there's likely to be some pressure. And at some level, if you just have solicitation for a substantial percentage of the outstanding shares at some fixed price with some fixed deadline, you're frequently going to end up seeing that as a tender offer. The next topic that I wanted to briefly talk about is, and this is a little bit kind of making the jump to tomorrow's topic, but I guess more in preparation for that, which is the considerations in preparation for a private capital raising. And there is, whenever someone says, okay, well, we're gonna raise capital, what do we need to do? I wanted to kind of lay out these issues to think about that will drive how this offering would happen. The first is a question of, okay, how much capital is needed and the reason for the need, because that's going to need to be disclosed in terms of the reason for the need. Certainly the amount of capital raised is going to need to be disclosed. You need to determine that, and that frequently, depending on the context, depending on the demand, may change as you go through, but it's kind of a front-end decision. The impact on the existing owners and their ongoing control, thinking about whether or not they are going to need to consent to the actions that are taken. The target investors, as I talked about before, depending on who the investors are, will govern what the disclosure and the interaction and how it happened, how that interaction and offering goes off, you know, comparing offering to three existing shareholders as opposed to going out to a wide group of either 100 employees or 100 contacts and providing, you know, a full-blown PPM that describes all of the upside and downsides and how the money is going to be used. Those are likely to be fairly different transactions. the type of security to be offered, whether or not this is going to be in the company context, whether or not this is going to be an LLC interest or a share of stock, a preferred stock, a convertible stock. In the fund context, this is largely, it's either going to be an LLC interest or more likely a limited partnership interest, and the details of what needs to be disclosed, the risks that are associated. If you have a very stable company that is issuing debt, then presumably the risks are much lower, so you get a little bit more comfortable without getting into the details of items that may impact profitability in the short term, if you're comfortable that you are going to be able to pay back the debt in the way that it's promised to be repaid. Also want to take into consideration whether or not the securities are available to be offered by the company, just making sure that if you're issuing stock, you have that stock available under the charter, and if you don't, how you're going to go about making that available, whether or not it's a requirement of a board consent, a stockholder consent. If you have a number of series or classes of stock, getting each of those parties to consent to the transaction. Thinking about the current structure of the company, whether that's currently an S corp, a C corp, an LLC, a limited partnership, etc. Whether or not that structure is the appropriate structure if you're going to go out to offer capital, or if you are doing an M&A transaction, whether or not it makes sense before or in connection with the transactions or the offering to change the current structure of the company. The existing stockholder and director approvals, I think I touched on that a little bit in terms of the stockholder. There may also be director approval requirements. Certainly, stockholder and director are likely to come up in the M&A transaction context, but also in the capital raising context. And then the final one I have listed here, although I'm sure there are many others, is engaging an investment bank or a broker to assist with the capital raising, and then always keeping in mind the finder issues. And that the finder issues I'm referring to, that's the question of whether or not someone is acting as an unlicensed broker-dealer. Frequently, people will want someone to help, and they will say that they have a finder, which is someone that presumably is not licensed, but those finders can frequently raise questions or problems if they are acting as a broker-dealer, but they're unlicensed, even though the company or the individuals are thinking of them as not as brokers but as finders. And I think that I then get to slide 25, which is the beginning of my discussion of issuing securities under the 33 Act, which I think is a good place to break here so that I can cover that topic in part two. So I will, I guess, turn it back over to Nate at this point, if that's appropriate.
No, Eric, I think that's a perfect place to take a pause and come back and resume tomorrow. Let's open up the program and see if we have any questions from our listening audience. Nicole, can you provide those instructions to our audience?
Certainly. If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch-tone phone followed by the one key. That's star one. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Eric, while we wait to see if we have any listener questions, I've got one or two for you. Coming back to the definition of securities, I'm curious, in your practice, where do you see companies most often go wrong? And assuming that securities encompasses obviously corporate stock, but not other sorts of investment contracts.
I guess the most frequent place is, well, frequently in the real estate context, I see people thinking, okay, we're just investing in real estate, and so the securities laws should not apply. And there's, in the private company context, there's a lot of, there's some fairly easy to deal with, but unexpected requirements to file to cause the company to comply with the 33 Act. If you have a, you know, for example, an LLC that owns an piece of real estate, and you've got 10 different people that are going to help finance that, and they all invest in the LLC, and you've got one of them that's the manager, and the other ones, other people are just kind of putting money in, then you've got an offering of securities that you have to find an exemption for. And the real estate context, I think that gets looked over a lot. And then the other item is in kind of unique investment structures. I've certainly seen people feel like, okay, that's not a security because it's an investment, as I mentioned, in an orange grove or a tax piece. And there's definitely been cases litigated and outcomes, and people have found themselves having not complied with the securities laws, resulting in them having to give all the money back that was invested. That gives the investor essentially a put right on the stock that they have, which is often referred to as a rescission right. So they go back to the company and say, okay, if things went badly, it doesn't matter to me because I just get all my money back plus interest, is usually the way it plays out under state law. So those are kind of the topics that usually trigger that item.
So primarily real estate, but also non-traditional asset classes. It probably also comes up, at least in recent years, maybe investments in something like a fractional interest in a piece of art.
Yes.
Something else that one would not think of as conventional asset.
Yep. No, I think that's another good example. If you're investing in a piece of art and you're doing it with a bunch of other people and someone else is managing it, it's possible that is also a security. There, if it is just holding that piece of art, there may be some argument that it's not, if that piece of art is doing nothing other than sitting in a room somewhere, because there's not kind of relying on the efforts of others. So there's an argument that maybe it wouldn't apply. If you have a piece of art, and I'm kind of doing this analysis on the fly a little bit, but the way to think about it is, if you have 10 pieces of art and one person's managing the buying and selling, and you're just going to own kind of a tenth of whatever he buys and sells, that looks like a lot like a security. If 10 people get together, buy one piece of art, and it sits in a room somewhere, then that may be less likely to be a security. But it gets very fact-specific on those types of items.
Fascinating area. Nicole, do we have any questions from our audience?
We do not have any audio questions at this time.
Well, Eric, we've come very nearly to the end of our time, so I'm going to thank everybody for joining us and remind you that if you have a question which either you weren't able to ask today or one occurs to you later, Eric's contact information, his phone number and his email address have been provided on your written material, and we certainly encourage you to reach out to him. Once again, my name is Nathaniel Trelease, and on behalf of Eric Smith, who joined us today from Baltimore, thank you for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. Nicole?
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's program.